You are listening to Revealing Relationships, the Family and Friends of Franklin Pierce, a special issue of Historical New Hampshire, published in 2005 by the New Hampshire Historical Society.
Franklin Pierce and Bowdoin College Associates, Hawthorne and Hale, by Peter A. Wallner, author of the Pierce biography, Franklin Pierce, New Hampshire's Favorite Son. The strength and longevity of Franklin Pierce's friendships with important figures in antebellum America proved a significant factor in his life and career. Pierce developed close relationships with New Hampshire native Daniel Webster, anti-slavery Senator John Parker Hale, writer Nathaniel Hawthorne, and Southern political leader Jefferson Davis. The diverging course of two of these friendships, both of which began at Bowdoin College, reveals much about Pierce and the time in which he lived. Close friendships formed in college tend to be of two types. Social friends share activities or clubs while together in school, but can quickly lose contact after graduation. Mutually dependent friends form a permanent alliance that may survive intact for a lifetime. The friendships between Franklin Pierce and Nathaniel Hawthorne, and between Pierce and John Parker Hale, were of the latter type, one lasting till death, and the other continuing steadily for over 20 years before burning out in the heat of the slavery issue. Pierce was the first to arrive at Bowdoin College in September 1820, a 15-year-old who had recently completed 2 years in boarding schools preparing for the college entrance exam. Though younger than most of his classmates, Pierce made friends easily because of his outgoing personality, athletic talent, and ability to get along with people of all ages and backgrounds. The son of Revolutionary War hero Benjamin Pierce, who had attained wealth and political prominence in the hill country of southwest New Hampshire, Pierce inherited his father's hail fellow well-met manner. Growing up amid the social atmosphere of the lively tavern his parents operated likely nurtured Franklin's congenial nature. Though he was an immature and often indifferent scholar, Pierce's winning personality made him a leader in his class within a year after arriving at Bowdoin. College friends. Pierce met Nathaniel Hawthorne in September 1821 during the two young men's journey by stagecoach to the rural Maine campus where Hawthorne was to enroll as a freshman. Though 6 months older than Pierce, Hawthorne had taken longer to attain the educational background needed to matriculate in college. This was not the only difference between the youths. Hawthorne never knew his father, a ship captain who died in Suriname when the boy was only 3. Young Hawthorne grew up with his mother, adoring sisters and bachelor uncles who spoiled him to the extent that he often refused to attend school and got away with it. Because of his mother's poverty, the family spent several years living in rural Maine, where Hawthorne was able not only to avoid school, but also to live a wild existence, roaming the forests, hunting, fishing, and absorbing a love of nature and of solitude that remained ingrained in his character. Less socially adept, unsure of himself, and somewhat reclusive, Hawthorne quickly fell under the spell of his confident and charming new friend. In the fall of 1823, John Parker Hale was the last of the three to enroll at Bowdoin, arriving when Pierce was entering his senior year and Hawthorne returning as a junior. Hale came from a prosperous Portsmouth, New Hampshire family and may have chosen Bowdoin over Harvard because his cousin Bill Hale was a junior at the school and one of Pierce's large circle of friends. The fact that the Hale family was Federalist normally would have deterred his becoming friendly with Pierce and Hawthorne. The student body was divided into two competing debating societies, the Pusinians and the Athenians. The former was the oldest society on campus and attracted most of its members from established Federalist families. The Athenians were the newer, more democratic group and attracted Jeffersonians like Pierce. By the time Hale arrived, Pierce was president of the Athenians, and Hawthorne had joined under Pierce's influence. Pierce soon worked his charms on young Hale, whose gregarious personality was more like his own than like Hawthorne's, and Hale went against family tradition to throw in his lot with the Athenians. It was a decision that would have lifelong consequences for the two young men. Within the student body, Pierce's influence was widespread. Besides heading the Athenian Society, he also formed the only military company in the history of the college. Captain Pierce, in an attempt to provide recreation and instruction for his fellow students, led the Bowdoin cadets in their daily drills on the grounds in front of the president's house. The Reverend William Allen, the college's president, objected to the noise and ordered a halt to the activity. When Pierce refused to comply with Allen's order, animosity grew between the students and the college authorities, resulting in the junior class going on strike. Pierce was accused of leading the rebellion, but the college records do not acknowledge the event. Pierce's father took note of his son's role, however, and in a rare letter admonished him about his behavior. In later years, classmates fondly recalled the strike and Pierce's key role. Pierce's leadership was evident in his personal relationships as well. Hawthorne's biographers credit Pierce with bringing the enigmatic, insecure Hawthorne into more regular contact with peers for the first time in his life. Though younger, Pierce acted like an older brother, drawing out the more circumspect future novelist. Hawthorne, under his friend's influence, even joined the Bowdoin Cadets as a private. He spent considerable time at Ward's Tavern near the campus but off-limits to students, where he played cards and drank wine. Pierce, though more interested in physical pursuits such as hunting in the woods that surrounded the campus, undoubtedly frequented the tavern as well. It was Ward's Tavern, though, that fostered the friendship between Hawthorne and Hale. Hale's storytelling ability and ribald sense of humor, bordering on buffoonery, was a delight to the tavern patrons, including Hawthorne. None of the three young men distinguished himself as a scholar. Pierce had the best record. After finishing at the bottom of his class in his first 2 years at Bowdoin, he turned himself around through assiduous attention to his academic responsibilities and many late nights to rise to fifth in his class of 17 by the time of graduation. He was most proficient at Latin and was chosen on two occasions to speak at public exhibitions. He also gave a 7-minute address at his graduation in August 1824. Hawthorne refused to declaim, even though public recitation was a weekly requirement of all students, and this hurt his academic standing. Hale, on the other hand, attempted to apply his talent for buffoonery to his weekly declamation and Latin translation, and occasionally offended his professors with his liberal interpretations. His good cheer and skill in debate led him to become president of the Athenian Society during his junior year. Out in the World. For Hawthorne and Hale, graduation brought uncertainty as to a future career. But Pierce, after leaving Bowdoin, began studying law immediately. By 1827, he was practicing law from an office set up for him by his father across the street from the family homestead in Hillsboro. His father's political career was also flourishing, and the old general was elected governor of the state in 1827 and 1829. Pierce began his own political career during this time, gaining election to the state legislature in 1829 and being re-elected each of the next 4 years. When his fellow members chose him Speaker of the House in 1831, he was, at age 26, the youngest man to serve in that post. Pierce's rise to political prominence corresponded with the growth of the Democratic Party in New Hampshire under the leadership of Isaac Hill and Levi Woodbury, to whom Pierce attached himself during these early years. Pierce thoroughly absorbed their belief in limited government and support for the common man, particularly the yeoman farmer. Following graduation in 1825, Hawthorne retreated to his mother's house in Salem, Massachusetts. His self-imposed exile in a third-floor bedroom lasted several years and enabled him to write many short stories, which he published using pseudonyms. Hawthorne's first novel, Fanshawe, which is set in a small country college, prompted a congratulatory letter from Pierce, who predicted great success as a writer for his old college chum. Whether or not Pierce recognized himself in one of the novel's characters, Hawthorne biographers have noted such a resemblance in the novelist's description of the gallant and headstrong Edward Walcott. He is tall, and the natural grace of his manners had been improved, an advantage few of his associates could boast, by early intercourse with polished society. His features also were handsome and promised to be manly and dignified when they should cease to be youthful. His character as a scholar was more than respectable, though many youthful follies, sometimes perhaps approaching next to vices, were laid to his charge. But his occasional derelictions from discipline were not such as to create any very serious apprehensions respecting his future welfare. Hawthorne was impressed in turn with Pierce's rise to political prominence. On learning of his friend's re-election as Speaker in 1832, Hawthorne jokingly predicted Pierce's future course with remarkable foresight. "If I were in your place, I should like to proceed by the following steps. after a few years in Congress to be chosen governor, say at 30 years old, next senator in Congress, then minister to England, then to be put at the head of one of the departments. That of war would suit you, I should think. And lastly, but it will be time enough to think of the next step some years hence. The 1832 session of the New Hampshire legislature also marked the arrival of John Parker Hale on the political scene as a Democratic representative from Dover. Hale's conversion to Jacksonianism did not follow directly from his membership in Bowdoin's Athenian Society. Upon graduation, Hale was torn between a career as a teacher or as a lawyer. He chose the latter and studied under attorneys who had once been staunch Federalists but were now supporting President John Quincy Adams. The first party system of Federalists versus Jeffersonian Republicans was transitioning into a new alignment of Whigs against Democrats. This second party system would emerge in the years between 1828 and 1832, as Andrew Jackson won the presidency from Adams and proceeded to secure his ascendancy by creating a national party structure through the use of government patronage and through his strong opposition to the National Bank. Hale's eventual alliance with the Jacksonian Democrats appears to have been the result of a combination of factors: expediency caused by personal ambition, philosophical agreement with the strict constructionism and limited government espoused by the Jacksonians, and the influence of Frank Pierce. The latter's meteoric rise to prominence in state politics helped pave the way for his friend Hale to be accepted by the suspicious Isaac Hill and Levi Woodbury, who, knowing Hale's family history, doubted the sincerity of his conversion. Pierce looked out for Hale's interests by naming the freshman legislator to a select three-man committee assigned to recommend to the entire body a direction to take on the temperance issue. Temperance societies around the state were petitioning for laws to restrict the sale of alcohol. Hale recommended that temperance should be an individual's choice and not a subject for restrictive, punitive legislation. Pierce agreed with this conclusion and may have influenced it. Hawthorne took a jaundiced view of Hale's motivation. Remembering Hale's heavy drinking during college days, Hawthorne wrote to Pierce that Hale's position on the issue was quite characteristic and consistent. I presume he gives the retail dealers as much of his personal patronage as ever. In fact, Hale had become a teetotaler. His abstaining from alcohol would prove a lifetime commitment, but Hawthorne did not know this, as the two men had not communicated since college. Their friendship, like so many formed in college, did not survive their separation from Ward's Tavern. The two men would continue to revolve like planets, however, around the strong gravitational pull of the dynamic and dominant Frank Pierce, who continued to influence their lives. In those days, writing fiction did not often provide an adequate means of livelihood, and despite favorable reviews, Hawthorne struggled financially throughout his life. Increasingly, he relied on a network of friends to provide the sustenance that allowed him to continue his writing. He saw Pierce occasionally during these years, as, for example, during a trip to New Hampshire in 1831 to inspect the Shaker community near Concord. Pierce was in town at the time for the legislative session. Hawthorne liked the communal atmosphere of the Utopian Society, but found the group's religious practices bizarre. A few years later, Pierce embarked on a campaign to acquire a government patronage position for Hawthorne. He was helped in this by one of Hawthorne's Bowdoin classmates, Horatio Bridge. The first plan was to find their mutual friend a place as historian on the South Seas expedition of Captain Charles Wilkes. This adventure appealed to Hawthorne, whose father was a sea captain, but Wilkes's expedition was delayed, and Hawthorne was not chosen to participate. A more practical position for the writer was obtained in the Boston Custom House, where Hawthorne served as measurer of coal and salt. Pierce's influence was useful in lobbying with the Van Buren administration, as well as with George Bancroft, the Massachusetts political leader and historian who was then the collector of the Port of Boston. During his tenure at the Custom House, Hawthorne spent much time in the home of Pierce's half-sister Elizabeth, whose husband, General John McNeil, was surveyor of the Port of Boston. Honest Convictions. Pierce was equally solicitous of the needs of his friend John P. Hale following the latter's defeat for re-election to the legislature in 1833. The same election saw Pierce chosen for the United States House of Representatives. Once in Washington, he began lobbying immediately for Hale to be named federal district attorney for the state of New Hampshire. After Hale's appointment by President Jackson, Pierce advised him in a brotherly manner to hold steadily on, and nothing can cramp or check you in a prosperous and brilliant career. Hale would return the favor a few years later by working within the state Democratic Party for Pierce's election to the United States Senate. Pierce's assistance to his two friends extended to more personal matters as well. When Hale's younger brother Clarkson needed a job, Pierce invited the young man to Washington to serve as clerk for a Senate committee Pierce headed. A few years later, Clarkson joined the Navy and went AWOL. Hale asked Pierce for assistance, and Pierce interceded with the Secretary of the Navy, who agreed to allow Clarkson to turn himself in at the Portsmouth Navy Yard without punishment. Pierce also advised Hale on the kind of evidence Congress required in order to grant a military pension to a New Hampshire man Hale was representing. During his first session in the Senate, Pierce became involved in a tragic event concerning another Bowdoin College friend, Representative Jonathan Cilley. Cilley and Hawthorne had been particularly close in college, and Pierce and Cilley lived in the same boarding house following Cilley's arrival in Washington as a freshman congressman in December 1837. Cilley and Representative William Graves of Kentucky became embroiled in a controversy over a charge Cilley made against a Whig newspaper editor. The result was a duel in which Cilley was killed. Pierce, devastated by the outcome, had advised Cilley in the days leading up to the duel. Hawthorne was equally upset and wrote Cilley's obituary, which appeared in the United States Magazine and Democratic Review. Pierce poured out his grief in a letter to Hale, who also knew Cilley. "I am full of grief. My mind dwells upon the subject, and I know not when to stop." For Hawthorne, who hardly counted himself a politician, the intimate connection with friends in the Democratic Party and the patronage offered him by that party inspired in him a permanent allegiance. He would faithfully support the party of his friend and patrons throughout the remainder of his life, despite tremendous pressure from the literary community of Massachusetts to join their reforming causes. Hale was more independent. Throughout the 1830s, Pierce in Washington and Hale in New Hampshire carried on a frequent and intimate correspondence. Political matters predominated as the two men kept each other informed of national and state issues. Soon the issue of slavery intruded into their relationship. In 1835, militant abolitionism suddenly emerged in New Hampshire as the American Anti-Slavery Society established chapters around the state. The presence of abolitionist speakers and their intransigent message threatened the peace and unity of many a New Hampshire town and parish. The Democratic Party closed ranks in condemning the abolitionists, shouting them down whenever and wherever they tried to speak. United States Senator Isaac Hill, a newspaper editor and state Democratic Party leader, led such an anti-abolitionist rally in Concord, and when the Reverend George Storrs came to Dover to promote abolitionism, John P. Hale stood up in a meeting to condemn Storrs' message and was instrumental in forcing the abolitionist to leave town. Pierce was equally concerned about the rise of abolitionism and declared in a letter to Hale in December 1835, "One thing must be perfectly apparent to every intelligent man. This abolition movement must be crushed, or there is an end to the Union." Hale seemed to agree at the time, but his views on the issue changed considerably over the next few years. Of more immediate concern to Hale, however, was the loss of his job as federal district attorney in 1841 with the ascendancy of the first Whig presidential administration. Pierce resigned from the Senate shortly after and returned to New Hampshire. The state Democratic Party had been split between radical and conservative elements on the issue of railroad and bank charters. Both Pierce and Hale supported the radicals, who opposed special privileges for corporations. Together, they effectively seized control of the party, thereby ending the reign of Isaac Hill. In a debate with the conservatives, Hale deplored the arbitrary and tyrannical proceedings of corporations and their illegal and high-handed usurpations. In 1842, Pierce, who had moved to Concord in 1838, became the chairman of the state party. Pierce immediately set out to help Hale gain the nomination to a seat in the United States House of Representatives. Hale's candidacy was not an easy sell to other party members. The state party convention of 1842 nominated him on the second ballot, while having confirmed the other nominees on the first ballot. Some still questioned Hale's fidelity to the party. Isaac Hill, moreover, attacked Hale during the campaign for alleged corruption in his position as district attorney. Hale had reportedly applied to the government for fees greatly in excess of what was proper, and Pierce was asserted to have lobbied in the Senate for Hale's claim to be paid. Hale was able to answer these charges with an effective defense in the newspapers, and he succeeded in winning the election. Immediately upon taking his seat in the House, the new representative displayed an independent streak. He voted against the infamous gag rule, which restricted the right of petition on the issue of slavery. This rule had to be voted on by each new session of Congress, and no New Hampshire congressman had voted against it, with the exception of Pierce himself in 1838. Hale's vote caused some difficulty back home, both for Hale and for state party chair Frank Pierce. One newspaper editor in Newport called on the state party to censure Hale. Pierce, who was rather ambivalent on the gag rule, did not endorse Hale's censure, yet he had to endure a tumultuous town meeting in Concord, in which the abolitionists attempted to praise Hale for his vote while condemning the state's other congressional representatives. In an attempt to embarrass Pierce and the Democratic Party, all opposition groups, temperance supporters, Whigs, and conservative Democrats, joined with the abolitionists to support the resolution against the three congressmen. A quick adjournment of the meeting prevented the resolution from coming to a vote. Pierce, however, must have begun to question his loyalty to Hale and what it might mean to the unity of his party. At the state party convention in November 1844, Hale was duly renominated for a second term. He perhaps drew a too hasty conclusion from this success, which occurred in spite of his vote on the gag rule and because of the continuing patronage of the party chair. In a letter to his wife, Hale exulted at his renomination. "It is gratifying to me, mainly as an evidence that some independence of thought, speech, and action on the part of their representative is tolerated and approved by the people of New Hampshire." But his place in the party was dependent on Pierce's friendship rather than on Hale's own record. The election in 1844 of James Polk, a Democratic president pledged to the annexation of Texas, posed a serious dilemma for Hale. Not only was the National Party committed to territorial expansion, but the New Hampshire Democratic Party convention and the state legislature also supported Texas annexation. The legislature went so far as to instruct the state senators to vote for it and to urge its representatives to do the same. Hale informed his wife Lucy that he had no intention of doing so, even though he understood that a stand against annexation would likely work against his re-election to Congress. To test his position that the annexation of Texas was a Southern plot to add slave states to the Union, Hale offered a resolution in the House to create two states out of Texas, one slave and one free. A unanimous vote of Southern representatives defeated even Hale's preliminary effort to suspend the rules and offer the resolution, confirming his conviction. He then determined to explain his position to the voters of New Hampshire in a letter sent to 1,400 Democrats. The letter, which reached the state on January 15, 1845, proved the last straw for State Party Chairman Franklin Pierce. Going over the heads of the party leaders and publicly rebuking the party platform was, from Pierce's perspective, the ultimate betrayal. He immediately set out on a course to strip Hale of the party's nomination for re-election to the House. Receiving nearly unanimous support from party leaders around the state, Pierce confidently called a party convention for February 12th in Concord. The result was that the Democrats removed Hale from their ticket less than a month before the upcoming March election. The political split from Hale also ended the friendship between the two men, despite a personal letter from Hale to Pierce explaining his position and his reasons for the public letter to New Hampshire's Democrats. In his letter, addressed to Friend Pierce, Hale wrote, "Whether I am correct or not in the views I have lately taken on the Texas question, they are my honest convictions. Seeing no reason why his action should result in angry denunciation or crimination, Hale appealed to his longtime friend. I believe in conscience, in duty, in right and wrong, and above all in God, who is over all. I have acted with honest motives." Pierce was undoubtedly moved by Hale's personal appeal, but he was clear in his duty as party chairman. Claiming to express his deepest feelings, Pierce replied, "You knew that many of us had advocated annexation with zeal. If it were, as you consider it, a zeal without knowledge, we had a right to expect that even our ignorance would be treated by you with forbearance, and not with this rude, sweeping denunciation." As Pierce saw it, Hale had held the supporters of annexation up for the scorn of earth and judgment of heaven, as well as for judgment at the ballot box. Pierce concluded, "Nothing has occurred in the politics of this state to give me so much pain as your movement, and the action which it has rendered indispensable for the vindication of the party, and indeed for its preservation. Thus ended a friendship of more than 20 years. The political issue could not be as easily disposed of as the friendship, however, and Pierce and Hale would meet in a famous debate in Concord on June 5, 1845. A third-party movement, the Independent Democrats, had emerged around Hale following his expulsion by the Democrats. Three candidates competing in the March election meant that no one received the required majority. Another election was scheduled for the fall, and with Congress adjourned, Hale returned to New Hampshire to campaign on his own behalf. The Texas question had already been disposed of by Congress, so Hale turned his attention to the dictatorial actions of Pierce and the party leaders. His continuous and personal attacks around the state required a response from Pierce, and the two met in debate at the Old North Church. The 2,000 in attendance, including members of the legislature, which had adjourned for the occasion, heard the two men, both schooled in debate from their Bowdoin College days in the Athenian Society, square off around the issues of the day. Hale spoke of his moral convictions regarding the extension of slavery and admitted to committing the unpardonable sin of going against the leadership of his party. Pierce defended the annexation of Texas because it was the will of the people of that territory and did not increase the number of slaves. He accused Hale of being the dictator by forcing the issue upon a reluctant electorate. Hale's closing statement that he hoped his tombstone would read, "He who lies beneath surrendered office, place, and power rather than bow down and worship slavery," according to one eyewitness, went through the audience like an electric shock. But Pierce, according to the same observer, was equal to the emergency. Every argument that was used by Mr. Hale was met in order. Those who remember General Pierce as a debater can well imagine the intensity of excitement that prevailed. In the course of the debate, Pierce correctly predicted a future alliance between the Independent Democrats and the Whigs, a coalition destined to elect a majority of the state legislature in 1846 and to promptly choose Hale for a full term in the United States Senate. Pierce's fidelity to the National Party, however, won him recognition at the federal level. Thus, it can be said that the conflict between the two old friends made Hale a senator and Pierce president. A Peculiar Tenderness. In the midst of the contest with Hale, Pierce's friendship with Nathaniel Hawthorne was renewed. The two had not seen each other for several years, prompting Hawthorne to write to Horatio Bridge in 1843, "Except yourself, Longfellow is the only college acquaintance about whom I really care much. Pierce, somehow or other, has faded out of my affection." Bridge determined to bring the two back together, and in May 1845 he brought Pierce to Concord, Massachusetts, to visit Hawthorne and meet his wife Sophia for the first time. Sophia recorded her initial impressions of Pierce. "I saw at a glance that he was a person of delicacy and refinement." She commented on the peculiar tenderness of Pierce as he walked with an arm around Hawthorne's shoulders and referred to him as Nathaniel. Since Sophia always referred to her husband as Mr. Hawthorne, Pierce's familiarity was touching. Bridge had an ulterior motive in re-cementing the friendship. Hawthorne, about to be evicted from his rental home, desperately needed help in finding a paying position. Pierce and Bridge were successful in bringing Hawthorne's plight before sitting members of Congress, and by the following winter, Hawthorne was appointed to the position of surveyor of the port of Salem, Massachusetts. The friendship between Pierce and Hawthorne strengthened for the same reasons that the friendship between Pierce and Hale ended. Both Hawthorne and Pierce were being pressured and assailed by abolitionists to support their cause. To Pierce, it was a political matter, not a moral one. He had always believed that issues like temperance and abolition had no place in the political system. They could not be compromised as other issues could, and would lead to division, and in the case of slavery, disunion. While he often expressed his dislike of slavery, which he found morally offensive, he demonstrated no sympathy for the slave. Pierce also questioned the sincerity of abolitionists, believing they were former Federalists with a political motive to divide and overthrow the Democratic Party throughout New England. Hawthorne had a stronger, gut-level reaction against any non-white population, and while opposing the harsher aspects of slavery, for example, the slave trade and the fugitive slave law, he saw no future upon which blacks and whites could live together freely and equally. "I have not the slightest sympathy for the slaves," he wrote, "or at least not half so much as for the laboring whites, who I believe, as a general thing, are 10 times worse off than the Southern Negroes." Hawthorne perhaps had in mind the conflict between his two college friends when he wrote of reformers in The Blithedale Romance, "They will keep no friend unless he make himself the mirror of their purpose. They will smite and slay you, and trample your dead corpse underfoot, all the more readily if you take the first step with them, and cannot take the second, and their third, and every other step of their terribly straight path. They have an idol, to which they consecrate themselves high priest, and deem it holy work to offer sacrifices of whatever is most precious." The Elements of a Great Ruler. While Pierce's friendship with Hale had been permanently severed, their political careers remained inexorably bound. They became like two men on a seesaw. When one man's political fortunes rose, the others fell. The Mexican War offered Pierce the opportunity to fulfill a lifelong goal of military service to his country. To Hale, the war was another case of Southerners attempting to expand the slave territory of the nation. He spoke out continuously in the Senate against the war. Pierce, upon his return from Mexico, attacked Hale for his lack of patriotism and particularly for casting the only negative vote on a resolution praising the service of Generals Scott and Taylor. Hale, moreover, appeared driven to agitate the issue of slavery, despite most Americans' desire to ignore it whenever possible. He even offered a resolution to ban slavery in the Oregon Territory, recently secured from Great Britain. The move was seen as needlessly provocative and insulting to the South, as no one believed slavery could ever exist in that distant land. The Compromise of 1850, which brought California into the Union as a free state in return for a tough fugitive slave law, gave Hale ample opportunity to demonstrate his determination. He joined Southerners John C. Calhoun and Jefferson Davis in voting against any kind of compromise. Pierce, on the other hand, supported the Compromise of 1850, despite some misgivings about the harshness of the fugitive slave law, which he admitted to in a speech in New Boston, New Hampshire, in the fall of 1850. He also praised the patriotic and nationalistic sentiments espoused by Daniel Webster, a Whig, whose famous speech on March 7, 1850, favored the compromise. The success of the compromise in temporarily calming the agitation over slavery was detrimental, however, to Hale's political fortunes. The Democratic Party had won election after election in New Hampshire, and its continuing majority in the legislature quashed Hale's hope for re-election when his Senate term expired in 1853. The nomination of Pierce by his party as presidential candidate in 1852 effectively sealed Hale's immediate future. In December 1852, the legislature chose Charles G. Atherton, the candidate favored by President-elect Pierce, as the state's new senator. With the advent of the Pierce administration, Hale could only wait and hope his former friend would fail. Hale had offered himself as a third-party candidate for president against Pierce, but attracted less than 5% of the vote nationally. Hawthorne had a different view of Pierce's candidacy for the presidency. When he first learned of the nomination, he wrote his friend, "I hardly know whether to congratulate you, for it would be absurd to suppose that the great office to which you are destined will ever afford you one happy or comfortable moment." He also offered to write a campaign biography of Pierce. The effort was a costly one for Hawthorne. He struggled to retell his friend's life in the most positive manner, while at the same time addressing Pierce's lack of prominence when in Congress, his views on slavery, and his military service in Mexico, which had been questioned by the Whigs because injuries kept him out of key battles. Expressing as well his own views on the subject of slavery, Hawthorne reported, "The biography has cost me hundreds of friends here at the North, who drop off from me like autumn leaves in consequence of what I say on the slavery question, but they were my real sentiments, and I do not now regret that they are on record." Writing the biography forced Hawthorne to assess the true character of his friend. He shared his thoughts with Bowdoin classmate Horatio Bridge. "I have come seriously to the conclusion that he has in him many of the elements of a great ruler, and that if he wins the election, he may run a great career. His talents are administrative. He has a subtle faculty of making affairs roll onward according to his will, and of influencing their course without showing any trace of his action." He concluded, "Pierce is deep, 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 luck withal, nothing can ruin him. Hawthorne also understood that Pierce's elevation to the presidency would offer his biographer a likely political appointment, and, as always, Hawthorne needed a job. He successfully lobbied Pierce to be appointed consul to Liverpool, a position of ample monetary rewards which would bring him as well the chance to visit England for the first time. Before embarking for England, Hawthorne visited Pierce in Washington to be present when the Senate voted on his confirmation. He reported that Frank was as free and kind in our personal interviews as ever he was in our college days, but his public attentions to me were few and by no means distinguished, only inviting me once to tea and once to go to a Methodist meeting with him, while other people were invited to dinner and made much of. Hawthorne failed to acknowledge that in these first days of his administration, Pierce was inundated with visitors and probably took his friends' loyalty for granted, while turning his immense charm on strangers and those whose support he needed to win. On this visit, Hawthorne escorted Jane Pierce on a boat trip down the Potomac to Mount Vernon, a rare excursion from the White House for the First Lady, who was grieving from the recent tragic death of her son Benny. Hawthorne would not see Pierce again for nearly 6 years. In the meantime, the president struggled to keep his administration afloat, and Hawthorne enjoyed the rewards of a lucrative position in England and the adulation his literary fame brought him in Europe. Pierce and Hawthorne rarely corresponded during these years. As Hawthorne explained to Bridge, "It is my instinct to turn the cold shoulder on persons in his position," as he did not want to give the impression of currying favor. When he did write to Pierce, it was to complain about a proposed bill which would limit the remuneration of consuls like himself. "For heaven's sake, do not let the next session pass without having this matter amended." But he also apologized for the dearth of correspondence. "I am sure, my dear general, that you will not impute it to any forgetfulness or lack of affection that I so seldom write you. But to tell you the truth, it is not quite so easy to write to the President of the United States as it used to be to write to Frank Pierce. By the by, we shall be on good terms again, and for my part, I don't care how soon." He continued to offer support to his friend, particularly with regard to the controversial Kansas-Nebraska Act and the resulting violence in Kansas. "What a storm you have had to face, and how like a man you have faced it. I long to talk over all these matters with you by the fireside, after the events of your government shall have become history." The decline in Pierce's popularity as president corresponded with a rebirth of Hale's political career. The Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened the possibility of slavery moving into those territories, was widely condemned in the North, and, along with the growth of nativism and the Know-Nothing Party, resulted in the defeat of the New Hampshire Democrats in the state election of March 1855, just in time for the legislature to select a new senator. Hale was duly elected and returned to Washington after a 2-year hiatus to be a thorn in the side of the already floundering Pierce administration. The senator wasted little time making known his feelings about his old friend. The new session of Congress was unable to elect a Speaker of the House due to the presence of Democrats, Whigs, Republicans, and Know-Nothings, none of which had a majority. The failure to organize the House meant that the president's annual message could not be read. Pierce waited for several weeks, but finally decided, against precedent, to send his message to Congress anyway. In an angry speech, Hale attacked the president for his presumption, as well as for the contents of his message. Pierce, he felt, had spent too much of the message discussing foreign affairs, offering only a brief statement on the agitation in Kansas. Hale believed that Pierce was abdicating his responsibility to impose order on Kansas, and that the negligence was deliberate to ensure a slave Kansas. According to Hale, Pierce had sent troops into Boston to guarantee the return of the fugitive slave Anthony Burns, but he would not send troops to Kansas to protect free soil settlers and ensure fair elections. Hale attacked Pierce personally, charging that the annual message was sent to Congress prematurely because Pierce wanted his pro-slavery views known to the Southern representatives in time for the Southern State Party conventions, which would meet in January 1856, to select delegates to the National Convention. According to Hale, Pierce still hoped to get Southern support for his renomination to a second term, but the effort was fruitless as there was no more chance of his being renominated than there is of one of our pages receiving that honor. Hale concluded that, by criticizing the opponents of slavery as enemies of the Constitution, Pierce comes down from that high place into the arena of a vulgar demagogue, and strips himself of everything which should clothe with dignity the office of President of the United States. I deny the issue. I hurl it back in his face. I tell him, when he undertakes to designate these men as enemies of the Constitution, he abuses and defames men whose shoe latchets he is not worthy to untie. One senator, in defending Pierce from the attack, noted that Hale's return to the Senate was a case of the devil taking care of his own. Hale, however, countered, "Sir, you know who brought me back here. It was the President of the United States and nobody else who has done it. If it had not been for the course which the President of the United States took upon this very subject, Kansas, if it had not been for the manner in which he outraged public sentiment in his native state, so that he has not got a single friend from that state in either house to say God bless him, I should not have been here. That is the devil who took care of me, the President of the United States." The savagery of Hale's remarks produced much political comment in the press and caused Pierce to turn his back on Hale at the president's New Year's levee at the White House. The reactions of the two men showed how far their relationship had deteriorated since their days at Bowdoin College, and how well Hale understood the political advantages of a feud between himself and the unpopular president. Throughout the 34th Congress, Hale continued to rail against Pierce on the issue of Kansas. As Pierce's chance for renomination slipped away, Hale's vituperation subsided somewhat, but he would never forgive his former friend for his inability to see the light on slavery. Just as Pierce viewed Hale's conversion to the anti-slavery cause as motivated by political ambition, Hale viewed Pierce's policy as president as motivated entirely by his desire for re-election. Hale summed up his views on the Pierce administration in a letter to his wife. "Upon the coolest reflection which I can bestow upon the subject, it appears to me that no man in modern times has inflicted such serious and lasting injury upon his country as Franklin Pierce." Pierce was responsible for the murders, arsons, and cruel outrages which have been committed in Kansas. As Pierce slipped out of the national limelight and Hale and the Republicans ascended to power, Pierce remained in the forefront of Hale's thinking. His biographer, Richard Sewell, contends that Hale's later feud with Lincoln's Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, was motivated in large part by Welles's former friendship with Pierce and his endorsement of Pierce for president in 1852. Still the same dear friends. If Pierce was bitter about being rejected by his own party, he never expressed it. Like the loyal soldier that he was, he did what he could to ensure the victory of his successor, James Buchanan, in 1856, including sending a new governor and troops to Kansas to restore order in time for the November national election. In the fall of 1857, Pierce and his wife Jane left the United States for an extended 2-year stay in Europe, beginning with a winter in Madeira and ultimately reuniting with Hawthorne and his family in Rome in the winter of 1859. Hawthorne had resigned his post as consul to Liverpool in February 1857, but remained in Europe on an extended tour, returning to the United States in the summer of 1860 after more than 7 years abroad. For both men, the reunion in Rome was a high point of their European travels. Their meeting proved another opportunity for Pierce to offer his old friend assistance. Hawthorne's teenage daughter Una, his oldest child, had been seriously ill for months, suffering from malaria. By the time Pierce arrived, her condition was critical. 13-year-old Julian Hawthorne recalled Pierce's first visit. "I recollect the first evening that Pierce came to our house and sat in the little parlor in the dusk, listening to the story of Una's illness. 'Poor child, poor child,' he said occasionally in a low voice. His sympathy was like something palpable, strong, warm, and comforting. He said very little, but it was impossible not to feel how much he cared. He knew of his own experience what it was to lose children." Pierce took Hawthorne on long walks around the city, visiting his friend as often as 3 times a day to check on Una and offer support. Hawthorne, who had not seen Pierce in 6 years, wrote, "He is singularly little changed. The more I see him, the more I get him back, just such as he was in our youth. This morning his face, air, and smile were so wonderfully like himself of old that at least 30 years were annihilated. He is a most singular character, so frank, so true, so immediate, so subtle, so simple, so complicated." Sophia Hawthorne noted that Pierce wrapped her husband round with the most soothing care, and after Una was out of danger, Hawthorne concluded, Never having had any trouble before that pierced into my very vitals, I did not know what comfort there might be in the manly sympathy of a friend. But Pierce has undergone so great a sorrow of his own, and has so large and kindly a heart, and is so tender and strong that he really did us good, and I shall always love him the better for the recollection of those dark days. He saw that the friendship was unbreakable. We have passed all the turning off places, and may hope to go on together, still the same dear friends, as long as we live. The Civil War only strengthened the relationship. Each man found himself struggling to make sense of the war and unable to embrace it. As the first shots were fired and even Washington, D.C. appeared threatened, Pierce told a crowd gathered in New Hampshire's capital, "There is no way for us as citizens of the old 13 states but to stand together and uphold the flag to the last." But his initial support for the war was tempered by his belief in what caused it in the first place. He explained to former Connecticut Governor Thomas Seymour, "Come what may, the fool schemes of Northern abolitionists, which we have resisted for so many years, are not to be consummated by arms on bloody fields through any aid of mine." And to his wife Jane he confessed, "My purpose, dearest, is irrevocably taken. I will never justify, sustain, or in any way or to any extent uphold this cruel, heartless, aimless, unnecessary war. Madness and imbecility are in the ascendant. I shall not succumb to them. Come what may, I have no opinion to retract, no line of action to change." Hawthorne was similarly conflicted. Contrary to Pierce, he believed that the Union is unnatural, a scheme of man, not an ordinance of God. While he supported the troops, he confessed to not understanding what they were fighting for. "If we pummel the South ever so hard, they will love us none the better for it, and even if we subjugate them, our next step should be to cut them adrift." He shared his views with Pierce during one of their many visits together during the war. Hawthorne wrote that Pierce is truly patriotic and thinks there is nothing left for us but to fight it out, but I should be sorry to take his opinion implicitly as regards our chances in the future. He is bigoted to the Union and sees nothing but ruin without it, whereas I, if we can only put the boundary far enough south, should not much regret an ultimate separation. Politically, Pierce maintained a low profile during the first 2 years of the war, but as the casualties mounted and the Lincoln administration suspended the writ of habeas corpus and imposed martial law on the nation, Pierce was unable to keep his own counsel. He was appalled at the treatment of Democratic Congressman Clement L. Vallandigham, who was arrested and tried by a military tribunal and forced into exile for his outspoken condemnation of the war. Closer to home, Pierce supported a Lieutenant Edgerly, who had been dismissed from the service for voting Democratic. Sidney Webster, Pierce's former secretary, informed Pierce that his brother had been denied promotion, despite being wounded at Fredericksburg, because of his known association with Pierce. New Hampshire's most gallant officer, Colonel Edward Cross, was continually denied promotion to Brigadier General, despite being wounded 11 times, because he was a known Democrat and a friend of Pierce. The former president was particularly sensitive to this issue, having been practically accused of treason by Secretary of State William Seward in December 1861. Seward had received an anonymous letter claiming that an FP was a member of a secret society bent on the overthrow of the government, and wrote Pierce demanding an explanation. When the letter proved a hoax, Seward did little to retract his veiled accusation, causing Pierce to insist on a Senate investigation of the correspondence between the two men. This pattern of denial of the basic freedoms guaranteed by the Constitution was too much for Pierce to bear. He agreed to preside over a state Democratic Party rally at the State House on July 4, 1863, and to give the keynote address. Sidney Webster warned him not to attend, fearing Pierce might once again become the victim of the Lincoln administration's vendetta against its opponents, but Pierce could not be dissuaded. Hawthorne, understanding the danger to his friend, was sitting on the stage at the rally held in Concord as Pierce made an impassioned speech attacking the Lincoln administration for suppressing the constitutional rights of freedom of speech and of the press. "Who, I ask, has clothed the president with the power to dictate to any one of us when we must or when we may speak? True it is that any of you, that I, may be the next victim of unconstitutional, arbitrary, irresponsible power. But we, nevertheless, are free men, and we resolve to live, or, if it must be, to die such." Though an estimated 25,000 Democrats cheered him heartily, the timing of the speech was unfortunate for Pierce. coming at the same time as the victories at Gettysburg and Vicksburg and the draft riots in New York, the speech was labeled traitorous by many, and Pierce's reputation in the North reached a new low. Hawthorne chose this time to dedicate his last book, Our Old Home, to his old friend, as a slight memorial of a college friendship, prolonged through manhood and retaining all of its vitality in our autumnal years. The dedication brought down on Hawthorne the same scorn that Pierce was receiving. Publisher James T. Fields had tried to get Hawthorne to eliminate the dedication, fearing it would hurt sales of the book, but Hawthorne was intransigent. My long and intimate personal relations with Pierce render the dedication altogether proper, especially as regards this book, which would have had no existence without his kindness, and if he is so exceedingly unpopular that his name is enough to sink the volume, there is so much the more need that an old friend should stand by him. When even Hawthorne's sister-in-law, Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, called Pierce a traitor, the author spoke eloquently in his defense. A traitor? Why, he is the only loyal man in the country, North or South. Everybody else has outgrown the old faith in the Union, or got outside of it in one way or another, but Pierce retains it in all the simplicity with which he inherited it from his father. It has been the principle, and is the explanation, and the apology, if any is needed, of his whole public life. When the book dedicated to Pierce was published, it produced just the reaction Fields had predicted. Harriet Beecher Stowe wrote Fields, "Do tell me if our friend Hawthorne praises that arch-traitor Pierce in his preface, and your loyal firm publishes it. I never read the preface, and have not yet seen the book, but they say so here, and I can scarcely believe it of you, if I can of him. What, patronize such a traitor to our faces? I can scarce believe it." Emerson reportedly cut out the dedication page, but others saw through the politics to recognize the importance of the friendship. Publisher Fields wrote in his diary, "It is a beautiful incident in Hawthorne's life, the determination at all hazards to dedicate this book to his friend." Hawthorne even brought Pierce to meet Fields, who had to admit he is at least a most courteous gentleman and interesting man, kindly and thoughtful. Fields's wife pointed out the potential sacrifice the always financially strapped Hawthorne was making. "He will dedicate the volume to Franklin Pierce, the Democrat, a most unpopular thing just now, but friendship of the purest stimulates him, and the ruin in prospect for his book because of this resolve does not move him from his purpose. Such adherence is indeed noble. Hawthorne requires all that popularity can give him in a pecuniary way for the support of his family." In fact, the book sold well despite all the controversy. Jane Pierce, in the final stages of a long bout with tuberculosis, thanked Hawthorne for the dedication. The added interest of the preface and the warm assurance of a friendship which has on both sides been so constant, so affectionate, and so true, gives the book a hold upon my regard, of which even The Scarlet Letter and Marble Faun are destitute. Jane's death in December 1863 gave Hawthorne another opportunity to support his friend. Traveling to New Hampshire for the funeral, Hawthorne was by Pierce's side as Jane was laid to rest in Concord's Old North Cemetery. As they stood at the graveside, Pierce, though completely overcome with his own sorrow, displayed ever-constant courtesy. In the midst of his grief, Pierce turned and drew up the collar of Hawthorne's coat to shield him from the bitter cold. As Long as We Live. A few months later, it was Pierce's turn to be by his friend's side at the end of his life. Hawthorne had grown noticeably feeble in the winter of 1864. By the spring, knowing that he was dying, he chose to spend his final days with Pierce. Sophia Hawthorne clung to the hope that a trip with Pierce would restore her husband's health. "I would not trust him in any hands now, excepting just such gentle and tender hands as yours." She acknowledged her husband's frail condition. "He really needs to be aided in getting in and out of carriages because his eyes are so affected by this weakness and his steps are so uncertain." She remembered how much Pierce had helped when Una was sick in Rome. "How singular it is that you should be the guard angelic of Mr. Hawthorne again as once before." Sophia concluded, "God bless you, dear General Pierce, for your aid in this sad strait." The two men met in Boston, and Pierce brought Hawthorne to stay with him in Concord until the weather improved. In mid-May, they left Concord by carriage, bound for Dixville Notch. By the third day, they had reached the Pemigewasset House in Plymouth. Along the way, Hawthorne asked Pierce if he had read the account of Thackeray's death, remarking what a boon it would be to pass away without a struggle. That night, Hawthorne fell asleep around 10 p.m., and Pierce left the door to their adjoining rooms open so he could look in on his friend during the night. At 3 a.m., Pierce noticed that the usually restless Hawthorne was lying in the same position he had been earlier. Hastening softly to his bedside, I could not perceive that he breathed, although no change had come over his features. I seized his wrist, but found no pulse, ran my hand down upon his bare side, but the great, generous, brave heart beat no more. The boon of which he spoke in the afternoon had, before morning's dawn, been graciously granted to him. On packing up his friend's belongings for the sad final journey to Massachusetts, Pierce discovered an old pocketbook containing his own picture. He wrote to Horatio Bridge, "I need not tell you how lonely I am and how full of sorrow." A few days later, Pierce sat with Sophia and the children at the funeral in Concord, Massachusetts, as Hawthorne's literary colleagues, including Emerson and Longfellow, served as pallbearers. The Sleepy Hollow Cemetery was swirling with apple blossoms in the spring breeze as Hawthorne's casket was laid in the grave. Pierce picked up a handful of the blossoms and sprinkled them over the casket before turning to leave his friend of nearly 45 years. Over the next few years, Pierce reread all of Hawthorne's books, appreciating his friend's genius all the more upon reflection. He also continued to support Sophia and the Hawthorne children, taking a particular interest in young Julian, spending time with the young man, and helping pay for his education at Harvard. In his will, Pierce left money to each of the three Hawthorne children. Balancing the ledger. What to make of Pierce's friendships with Hale and Hawthorne? It is clear that each man depended on Pierce for support and patronage. Hale would never have been accepted by the State Democratic Party without Pierce's influence. Once Hale broke with that party, he knew his political fortunes would rise or fall in direct opposition to those of Pierce. After Pierce was removed from the political limelight nationally and in New Hampshire, Hale lost some of his political focus and effectiveness. In fact, Hale's later political career was highlighted by a series of bitter feuds and the ultimate rejection by the New Hampshire Republican Party, which denied him renomination to the United States Senate in 1865. Without a patron of Pierce's power and patience, Hale's natural tendencies proved self-destructive. Hawthorne also depended on Pierce's patronage to provide the sustenance that allowed him to continue writing. Hawthorne did what he could to balance the ledger with his campaign biography of Pierce and by his unwavering support of his increasingly unpopular friend and patron. The two men were soulmates. Pierce admired the genius and sensitivity of Hawthorne, and Hawthorne relied on Pierce's strength, compassion, and loyalty. One is left to wonder whether Hawthorne's literary colleagues, who were united in their opposition to slavery, might have influenced his opinions more if the dominating influence of Pierce was not so omnipresent in Hawthorne's life. While the friendship was somewhat one-sided, in that Pierce was able to do so much for Hawthorne and his family, the fact that Hawthorne wrote so frequently of his admiration for Pierce leaves a unique legacy by which to judge the much-maligned former president. There are far more biographies of Hawthorne than there are of Pierce, and each biographer has had to analyze this remarkable friendship in their attempts to understand the complex writer. In the end, Hawthorne succeeded in balancing the ledger of this lifelong friendship. The revelatory nature of Hawthorne's relationship with Pierce helps to ameliorate harsh political judgments of historians and others concerning the nation's 14th president. Pierce's friendships with Hale and Hawthorne demonstrate that he was neither weak, vacillating, nor easily manipulated, and that the motive for all of his political decisions was sincere patriotism and determination to preserve the Union and avoid a bloody civil war. He reflected, however, the prevailing opinion of his time and his views on race, and ultimately lacked the vision to foresee a reunited nation freed from slavery and headed toward economic prosperity, social justice, and world power.
You are listening to Revealing Relationships, the Family and Friends of Franklin Pierce, a special issue of Historical New Hampshire, published in 2005 by the New Hampshire Historical Society. Historical New Hampshire, the only statewide history journal, has been a regular publication of the New Hampshire Historical Society since 1944. Revealing Relationships, the Family and Friends of Franklin Pierce, was produced by the New Hampshire Historical Society in recognition of the November 2004 bicentennial of Franklin Pierce's birth. The Historical Society's publication and accompanying exhibition were part of a statewide collaborative effort on this occasion to re-examine the life and accomplishments of Franklin Pierce, the only U.S. president to date born in New Hampshire. The audio version of Revealing Relationships was narrated by John Walters and produced by Jody Peterson at Cliff House Audio for the New Hampshire Historical Society. Music performed by Colin McCaffrey and Dee Davis. Revealing Relationships, made possible with generous support from the Valette Nafosi Foundation.